Thank you, Aaron. And I want to really thank the organizers for arranging the talks in such a thoughtful way that I get to lean on the contributions of people who came earlier this morning. I am talking about kinetic recoupling of dark matter. I'm going to explain what that means in just a moment. First, I want to just give a shout out to collaborators on this project. There's Stefano Profumo at Santa Cruz. Logan Morrison was his grad student formerly. And Nolan Smith is currently finishing up his PhD at Santa Cruz. He's actually going to be moving to Canada in the fall. He's going to be at Ciela in Montreal. So I hope that those of you who are local get the chance to meet with him. I also want to just begin this talk with an apology to this fellow, Joseph-Louis Lagrange, because despite our discussions over the last couple of days, I am not really going to be writing down any Lagrangians in this talk. We're going to be a sort of a phenomenological level, so I apologize. But to get started, let me just give you a very broad overview of what I'll say in the next half hour. I'm going to introduce a new class of thermal history for dark matter, revolving around the nature of its kinetic decoupling. I'll remind you what that's about. I'll explain how one might go about implementing this alternative thermal history. And then I'll talk about the implications of that thermal history for the matter power spectrum. And of course, the upshot here is going to be that there is actually room to probe this kind of scenario using the kinds of small-scale structure probes that we can get from 21 centimeter, from the epoch of reionization, from the kinds of physics that we've been hearing about over the last couple of days. So to start off with, let me just sketch a little bit of philosophy that I like to bear in mind when probing dark matter agnostic to couplings with the standard model. This is, of course, what keeps me up at night. What do we do if we only have a sequestered dark sector? And if we only have gravitational interactions to play with, well, we have gravitational waves. That's one thing we can use. We have anything that can be affected by gravity, so photons that are bent by gravity. Think about lensing. And then we have how the baryons respond to gravity. And these latter two are really tracing the dark matter distribution. So if you want to characterize dark matter physics, and you want to only use gravity to do it, then short of gravitational waves, the dark matter distribution is going to be the best probe. And we've done a good job over the last couple of decades of assembling a wide range of experimental probes of dark matters clustering over various scales. So we have this very, very nice matter power spectrum that covers a wide range of wave numbers. And lambda CDM is a great fit so far. Now, the interesting piece here is what happens as we go to smaller scales. So right now, if you look back at this plot, it cuts off at wave numbers of order an inverse megaparsec. And this has been a kind of barrier in probing small scale structure. But there is an opportunity in the next couple of decades to go further with the classes of experiments that we've been talking about over the last couple of days. And this is actually, it's too bad that Julian isn't here, because this is actually his work that I'm going to be pointing to. But along the lines of what we heard about in the first talk this morning, if you suppress small scale structure, very small scale structure, then you can delay star formation. And that delayed star formation then tracks into evolution of the 21 centimeter fluctuations and global signal. So in particular, at these high redshifts where you're producing the 21 centimeter that we see today, the halos that you have available to form stars start at around 10 to the 6 solar masses. If you are lower than 10 to the 6 solar masses, you don't have an efficient way of cooling. You can't make stars. If you're above 10 to the 8 solar masses, you have atomic cooling available, so you'll reliably make stars. The middle is this interesting region where you're dominated by molecular cooling. And so that's where you have this whole story of Lyman-Werner feedback that we've been talking about a lot over the last couple of days. So, as it turns out, if you attenuate the amount of structure that you have between 10 to the 6 and 10 to the 8 solar masses at high redshifts, redshifts of order 10 to 20, then in principle you can change the star formation rate enough that you can actually see the impact on the star formation rate. So the claim from this paper by Julian and follow-ups is that you can actually probe the power spectrum on very small scales, much smaller than the inverse megaparsec that we saw in the plot I showed you before. So in particular, one can hope, in principle, to probe scales as small as 100 inverse megaparsecs. going up to 40 inverse megaparsecs. Once you hit 40 inverse megaparsecs, now you go beyond that 10 to the 8 solar mass halo size, and so you lose sensitivity. Everything just becomes a kind of global rescaling. This is a massively complicated story that we heard a lot about in the first talk this morning, right? So there are huge caveats on our actual ability to do this, and whether we actually get good probes of substructure in this regime is going to depend on the efforts of people like Rahul, who are doing the complicated work of properly simulating these small halos and determining whether we have these kinds of feedback effects on nonlinear scales where you actually get enhanced star formation. Things like this matter to make this probe work. For the purposes of this talk, though, I want to put those caveats aside, and I want to just look at this figure from Julian's paper. This is a plot of what you could hope to get as constraints on the matter-power spectrum from 21-centimeter experiments. So Edges and Hera, as kind of fiducial, global, and fluctuation experiments in 21-centimeter, are in principle able to get order one precision on the power spectrum at very high wave numbers. The bins are wide, but you still have these in this case, three non-trivial handles on the matter distribution at high redshift at small scales. So the question that I want to probe now is what we can do with these kinds of observables for dark matter microphysics. Are there any other classes of models that we can actually leverage these kinds of small-scale observables to go beyond the simple features that we already know to look for? Now, to explain what we might want to look for, let's go back to how these structures actually form, where we get them. Let me just remind you of the story of structure. So we start off with whatever primordial power spectrum we get from inflation, nominally, and then we have our first decoupling. We separate between the baryon photon fluid and collisionless dark matter. The baryon photon fluid has its own decoupling event where it separates into the free-streaming CMB photons and the baryons. The collisionless dark matter starts to settle into halos. The baryons then settle into those dark matter halos. And eventually, we form galaxies where we have enough matter, and otherwise we have maybe some non-luminous structures. But the key feature that I want to point your attention to in this story is that most of the properties of interest are actually fixed by the properties of decoupling events. It's when these transitions happen, when the baryons separate from the photons, that gives us the CMB. It's when the dark matter separates from the baryons that nominally gives us, in the WIMP case, for example, the dark matter abundance. These decouplings are extremely important. And in the WIMP case, a lot of effort has actually been spent on fleshing out the details of that decoupling. And in particular here, I'm referring to chemical decoupling, the abundance of the dark matter that we end up with if it's set by interactions with the center model plasma. So it's not just a question of what's the simplest WIMP model that gives you such and such an abundance. There are a lot of other effects that can come in that can change that simple picture and give you different relic abundances. And there we have one number we can probe, it's the relic abundance, and already we've been able to say a lot about what kinds of physics might be involved in setting that relic abundance. What I want to do now, though, is turn from that chemical equilibrium story to kinetic equilibrium. Let me remind you, chemical equilibrium is what you have when you have fast number-changing interactions. So you're quickly converting between dark matter particles and nominally standard model particles, but any bath. Kinetic equilibrium, on the other hand, is the phase space distribution that you maintain when you have rapid momentum changing interactions. So you have a lot of elastic scatters, let's say, with some bath. I want to point out, by the way, that the right diagram is not the only way you get kinetic equilibrium. If you have chemical equilibrium, you also have a lot of momentum exchange. That also gives you kinetic equilibrium. But kinetic equilibrium usually lasts a little bit longer than chemical equilibrium in typical, let's say, WIMP models. And that led to people asking the question of what happens if you go beyond the simplest story for kinetic decoupling. What happens when you have some extra ingredient and how the rapid momentum exchange actually stops? So here I'm going to put up the same plot that we saw before, these small-scale crises, missing satellites, too big to fail. These were motivators that maybe there's something going wrong on small scales. We want to attenuate small-scale power. And of course, one of the solutions to do that was warm dark matter. Maybe that's the most familiar. right? So if you start off with a cold dark matter simulation, you get a lot of interesting substructure. If you then have warm dark matter that actually decouples while it's relativistic, now you have this smoothing of small scale structure. You lose those satellites that you should be missing. But what people have already known for quite some time is that you can also do this not by having warm dark matter, but by having a delayed kinetic decoupling. In particular, if you have a dark matter species that's in kinetic equilibrium with a radiation bath, and you stay in equilibrium with that radiation bath a little bit longer than you usually would, that is actually enough to erase a lot of small-scale power. Now, you can actually see this in the power spectrum because a late-time kinetic decoupling actually mimics almost perfectly a warm dark matter scenario if you get the parameters right. So this plot here, this sort of typical power spectrum that you would expect to see for warm dark matter, really also stands in for a late kinetic decoupling from a radiation bath. Now, what I want to use as a little bit of motivation here is to say that if we have some structured dark sector, some non-minimal dark sector like we had in the first day of this workshop, maybe we expect that there's some interesting physics that comes into play around this epoch of decoupling. And this happens in the standard model. We have a lot of species that decouple around the same time. The kinetic decoupling of neutrinos, for example, is quite well spaced from its chemical decoupling. So what if we have some complicated structure that gives us something a little bit more complicated than this story? And there have been by now some generic predictions about what happens for various kinds of interactions that keep you in kinetic equilibrium. So people have gone so far as to write down effective operators and to consider for each one of these effective operators, how does the dark matter kinetically decouple? What does that do to the power spectrum? What constraints can you set from cosmology? And furthering that program, we now have this lovely ethos parameterization where we can we have a very nice basis, essentially, for interactions that could result in non-trivial phenomenology in the kinetic decoupling. And we can immediately start from ethos parameters and draw transfer functions. Now, what can we do beyond these generic predictions? Is there anything that these EFT treatments are missing? And I'd argue that there's actually one thing that you could be missing here, and that's non-trivial time dependence. So here I want to come back to the story for the chemical decoupling of the WIMP. In the case of chemical decoupling, we know that if we have some interesting non-monotonic interaction rate, for example, so if we have something like a resonance, or we have Sommerfeld enhancement, or we have a phase transition, we know that each of these things can substantially modify that one number that we can probe, which is the relic abundance, because it modifies the duration of that decoupling epoch. It modifies the annihilation rate. Now, what if we ask a similar question about the kinetic decoupling? What if we have a non-trivial time dependence in those momentum exchanging interactions? And the generic-ish new possibility that I want to suggest here that is going to be the maybe poster child for these non-trivial time dependences, is the notion of a kinetic recoupling. So what do I mean by a kinetic recoupling? I mean that I have some secluded dark sector. It's got a matter species and a radiation species. They have some momentum exchange interaction. They have some effective opacity between them. And at some point, the dark matter and dark radiation species decouple normally. Then later, the interaction rate increases, and they recouple. So you have an interaction rate with time that looks something like this, where you first go out of equilibrium, then come back for a bit, and then go away. So the maybe minimal thing to think of here is that you have some resonance in that scattering process, and you keep on going down until you hit that resonance. Now the interaction rate goes up again. So what does this sort of recoupling do to the power spectrum? Now, before getting into the details of that, I'm going to give you a brief advertisement for why you would think this would have non-trivial effects at all. Then I'll tell you a few ways to do it, and then we'll look at the structural effects in detail. So first of all, why should you expect that this is going to have any kind of effect? Well, remember that in the case of a late-time kinetic decoupling, where you have equilibrium with a radiation bath for longer than usual, you have damping of those perturbations by a few different physical effects. One is that you have just dark matter free streaming. That's always going to be there if you kinetically decouple while the dark matter is warm. The second thing that can happen is collisional damping. So you can basically form a dark analog of acoustic oscillations. And there's also induced damping. So you have the dark radiation is free streaming. It is still coupled in some way to the dark matter. So as the dark radiation perturbations are being erased by its free streaming, that is being imprinted on the dark matter. And there are different damping scales associated with each of these processes that have been reliably known and computed for a long time. But now if we have a recoupling scenario, we introduce a couple of new scales. So in particular, there are two time scales that I want to point out. There is the time between the first decoupling and the recoupling itself. I'm going to call that delta tau dec here. And then there is the duration of the recoupling. There is the time during which the dark matter is now coupled anew to the radiation bath. And those two time scales are going to influence different damping processes. So the free streaming is going to be interrupted in some way on a time scale of this first decoupling. That is the time that the dark matter has to free stream before equilibrium kicks in again. You can think the dark matter basically free streams and then hits a mirror suddenly. Right, everything turns on again. So that's going to change the free streaming. Collisional damping, that's going to change as well. That's going to change on the scale of the time during which the dark matter is recoupled to the radiation bath. And if we think of this as a brief event, that's going to be some smaller scale. And finally, the induced damping is also going to be set by that initial period of decoupling, because that's the time that the dark radiation has available to evolve on its own and smooth out perturbations before it talks to the dark matter again. So the basic picture here is that there are a few effects that should enter that should be distinct from a single kind of kinetic decoupling, and they should be in some way related to these two time scales. Having said this, I want to now take a step in the other direction, and let's think a little bit about how one would actually get such a kinetic recoupling to occur. And I mentioned three different possibilities when I started off. I mentioned a resonance. You have some low-lying resonance in this elastic scattering process that keeps you in equilibrium. You have Sommerfeld enhancement or phase transitions. These are all things I mentioned for the case of WIMP's chemical decoupling. In principle, they can all apply for a kinetic decoupling as well. So let's look at that. And let's start with the most boring, which is Sommerfeld enhancement. The reason I say this is boring is just because I don't want to have to work too hard as a model builder. Sommerfeld enhancement is an intrinsically non-relativistic effect. This is only going to take place when the dark matter and dark radiation have a relative velocity that is in some sense low. That's not going to happen because the dark radiation has to still be radiation. Can you accomplish some kind of non-trivial kinetic decoupling with Sommerfeld enhancement? Absolutely. But you would need an additional bath. And the reason I say that is you'd have to have some other dark matter species, which is coupled to the dark radiation. The Sommerfeld enhancement has to be between the two dark matter species. Okay.
Please. Between the dark matter and the standard.
Oh, okay, good. So everything I'm saying here, I just want to evade constraints to the extent possible. So I'm not even speculating on contact with the standard model here. This is all a secluded dark sector. In principle, you could do that. The biggest issue is going to be that you have to... you have to have a coupling that's big enough that you don't royally mess up everything, right? Because this is all happening. The upshot is going to be that if you want to see this, it has to happen fairly late, so you wouldn't want it to be coupled to standard model at that point.
Okay.
But you could do that.
So your radiation bath is standing in for something that's the temperature ish of the standard model.
Temperature ish, yes. So. I'm going to also let the temperature of that dark sector float in general, but yeah. Okay. Let's talk about a resonance. This is a little bit more interesting, but well, I'll show you what it does. So the naive idea here is if I put a resonance in the scattering process, now maybe I have some big peak in the scattering rate as a function of time. Maybe that gives me a recoupling. Well, maybe, but it's actually not obvious that this happens. If you just take the simplest case, you put in some mediator, you go and work out the matrix element near the resonance, you can expand it out and say at temperatures that are far from the resonance on either side, it's pretty clear that you actually don't get any enhancement to the scattering rate because of the competition with expansion. So maybe you look at this and your first thought is, oh, maybe this actually doesn't really give me any recoupling. Maybe it just sort of delays the decrease in the scattering rate. And it turns out that's not entirely true. You can increase the rate with a resonance and you can achieve this kind of recoupling, but it's a very tuned thing. This is one of the examples that, we kind of messed around a little bit numerically. We were able to find an example like this where, yeah, in principle, that's a recoupling, but is it really? I mean, that line there, you're not getting much below that line of, nominally kind of gamma over Hubble equals one. You're not really decoupling very effectively in the first place. And you can see that in the power spectrum that you get out of a model like this, in the sense that the orange curve, which reflects this kind of resonance here, that looks like it's just a sort of a slightly delayed decoupling that isn't as delayed as a really delayed decoupling. Right? You're sort of just pushing off the kinetic decoupling a little bit. So to get that to really work in an interesting way would require some fiddling. So let's turn to another case here. Let's think about a phase transition. Here you have considerable freedom. So the simplest thing to do is just to say I have some scalar, it's going to get a VeV, it's going to suddenly change the interaction rate, and that's going to give me a very spiky increase in the scattering rate. Now, of course, I'm making Joseph Louis happy here by showing you a Lagrangian, but I'm going to make him unhappy again because now I'm going to do nothing more with that Lagrangian. I'm going to only use it to inspire this form for the interaction rate as a function of time. So here the idea is that you have the usual decline in the scattering rate. Now at some point you undergo this phase transition and that increases the scattering rate. This phase transition I'm going to assume is instantaneous. That's not quite true, but on these timescales that's okay. So given this kind of large bump, it becomes pretty obvious that you can accomplish this kind of recoupling. Here you go from well below that dotted line to well above. Was there, yeah?
So which scalar is going through the phase transition?
I added a new scalar here, this phi 2. That phi 2 is going through the phase transition. And that's changing the, so this term over here, the chi and eta, chi is the dark matter, eta is the dark radiation, they're getting a large enhancement to their coupling.
Is it a normal phase transition?
That's the baseline assumption.
Okay, and so you computed like the normal transition rate, stuff like that?
We used some benchmark numbers from the literature. We didn't compute it ourselves, but we made sure that, like, yeah, you can do this, and it's not like the phase transition takes too long or whatever. So, given that, in the last 5 minutes, I want to tell you what happens to the matter power spectrum when you have such a kinetic recoupling take place. And here, let's start off with the basic story, just looking back to the linear perturbation equations. So if I write down the perturbation equations for dark matter and dark radiation, it's a coupled system that looks like this. I'm going to define this slip over here between the two velocity perturbations. And nominally, in the dark radiation perturbation equations, you have this shear stress over here, which has a whole hierarchy of equations that it's linked to. For good reasons, in a moment, I'm going to get rid of that term. The basic idea now is to say, let's take the simplest minimal thing that I can get some intuition for, which is an instantaneous tight recoupling. So basically, I put a delta function in the scattering rate. I go down, I go up, I go down. So what does this do? Here, I have after that recoupling takes place, I should basically have some coupled matter radiation fluid. So the velocity perturbations should snap together. The density perturbations should be related by this 3/4 of matter radiation. The shear stress should go away. And this means that the velocity perturbations in particular have to come together at some point. Right? They start off at two different places. When the recoupling happens, they have to meet somewhere. We can estimate where that happens, actually. We have to be a little bit careful because even though this difference between the thetas is quite small, the interaction rate is large. And if you look back at the perturbation equations, it's actually this product of the scattering rate and delta theta that is driving the equations. So we do have to be careful. I'm going to introduce a small parameter a little bit carefully. If you expand it, you get this system of equations. And now you can immediately ask the question of what happens to these perturbations immediately following a strong, tight recoupling. Well,
so given those parameters, is the bubble doing something?
Is what?
Is the bubble doing something during the phase transition?
Oh, no. So the assumption here is that the phase transition completes on a short time scale compared to the time scale of interest here. And that's something that we checked, that you can get a short, the phase transition itself is doing something like this to the interaction rate, right? Not this, right? But I'm assuming that I'm living over here where the phase transition is completed.
But the bubble wall, like a dynamics, introduce new perturbations.
That's true. In principle, they could. And you know, this transition is happening for some scalar that has some, you know, energy density that is an additional parameter. I haven't worked through what those perturbations do, but it's a good question. Okay. Now, if I want to estimate where those two velocity perturbations meet, I'm just going to linearize around the actual recoupling time and ask where those two thetas come together. That gives me this messy estimate for where the two perturbations meet. Okay. Now, given that, what we can actually expect, I'm not going to show you that equation right now, what we can expect is that there's a sudden change in theta, which corresponds to a sudden change in the time derivative of delta, the density perturbation, and we can look for that kick in the actual perturbations. So let me actually show you, if you evolve this in class, you can put in this kind of interaction rate that I showed you. Here's what you get. So on the left-hand side, as a function of time, you have in 1k, you have the evolution of the theta perturbations for the dark matter and dark radiation. The black line is what happens when you don't have this recoupling. That's the baseline case. The blue line is what happens when you do have the recoupling. And so you can see, okay, the thetas snap together. Not only that, they snap together at the place where we would predict from that expression at the top. So here in the right-hand panel, this is now as a function of k immediately after recoupling. The black line is what you have right before the recoupling takes place. The blue line is what you get by doing the Boltzmann equation numerically. The dashed curve is what you get from that equation up top. So now that we trust this computation, at least at the level of going from this simple estimate to a Boltzmann solver, now we can predict that kick. And we can make I'm going to just make the point from this that this kick is generally going to act to delay the formation of structure. So usually you have structure increasing over time in each k, and at some time you give it a kick, you decrease the derivative of delta, and depending on when you kick it, you can get widely different sizes of kicks, you can get widely different perturbations across different scales, but you have this scale-dependent delay in structure formation. Now you can go straight to the matter power spectrum, and you can ask, for maybe the case that would inspire you from a resonance, what does this do to the power spectrum? And remember, from a resonance, it looks pretty messy. It's hard to understand if there's anything unique happening with this versus a late time kinetic decoupling. But that's because we're actually conflating the scales that I mentioned earlier. So here there are actually three separate things that are changing in these plots. There's the height of the recoupling, there's the time at which you recouple, there's the duration of the recoupling. Those are all different between those three curves. So to make something that we can actually interpret, let's decouple those properties, and let's go instead to this phase transition case I described before. Let's actually use this as the scattering rate that we're going to use to get the power spectrum. Here, you can decouple when the phase transition occurs from how long it lasts. And you can see in particular that when it takes place tells you where the feature is in the power spectrum, right? So if I have a later time recoupling, I have a larger scale feature, and vice versa. The duration tells you how deep the feature is. What is the size of these dark acoustic oscillations that you create? So here I'm just going to flash this plot. This is the last content slide. I want to just show you here an example of a power spectrum with a kinetic recoupling. The blue curve is the recoupling scenario. The orange curve on there is what you would get for a late kinetic decoupling. And that actually, that orange curve is chosen by finding the late decoupling which most closely mimics the blue curve. So that's sort of as close as you could possibly get to the blue curve with a late time decoupling. And now you can see that we indeed have this very, very different set of features at small scales. So if you imagine doing those measurements of the very small scale power at, you know, 40 to 100 inverse megaparsecs, now, yes, all the complications from the first talk of the morning certainly apply, but at the level of a picture like this, it seems like you could make a distinction between these two cases. And you can actually go and say, here are the bounds that you could get as a function of the time at which the recoupling takes place and how long it lasts. I'm going to end here. I'm just going to make a note that one interesting thing to do with this is actually to treat what happens with freeze-in, because you can imagine a case where the dark matter freezes in, comes to equilibrium briefly, and goes out of equilibrium. If you don't spend a lot of time in equilibrium, some similar phenomenological implications should be there for the power spectrum. So that's another thing that we're going to check out down the road. I'm going to just leave the conclusions up here, just make the point that this is a way of using non-trivial time dependence in the interaction rate, as has been done for chemical decoupling in WIMPs, now to get some new non-minimal observable for a complicated dark sector. And we can do this in a way that we can get something more from the power spectrum than just looking for a cutoff. I'm going to end it there. Thanks, y'all, very much.
Question.
So, it was great stuff. Just one comment. I mean, you don't have to rely on projections for, say, the k equals 20 inverse megaparsec power spectrum, right? There are probes like high resolution,
like
FOAS structure. Presumably, that would have come a little bit down on your bounds that you showed. Yeah.
That's true. We don't, in those bounds, include those mid-scale probes. I mean, honestly, I think that the case for making this constraint plot is sort of as a proof of principle. I mean, I don't think that there's really a, you know, there's not some obvious physics target where I say I really want to live at that point in this parameter space. But it's certainly true that we should use those probes.
So have you thought about, so if you wanted to say use Milky Way substructure, for example, then you'd have to start to think about nonlinear in these models.
Absolutely.
Is that going to be like non-trivially different from the CDM case?
I mean, I think it will. I mean, so I say that on, so the first thing I should say is like, yes, I'm showing all these linear power spectra, right? And we're talking about very, very small scales. This is only sensible in some way because these projections that I'm comparing to are also these kind of extrapolated linear projections. To get actual projections where you can do this test rigorously, you need to do simulations. There's no other way to do it. And if we remember a couple of talks ago, there are nonlinear effects that may actually change the star formation story and may substantially change to what extent you can even probe these small scales. So short answer, yes, I expect it to change a lot.
And just so the recoupling really happens at late cosmic times.
Well, the reason that I'm putting it late in this picture is mainly as a way to, you know, get an observable in the 21 centimeter signal. But like, in principle, you can have that recoupling take place anytime you want. The question is, what observable are you going for, right? So, like, if you have another observable in mind that, you know, probes the phase space of dark matter at some early time, then in principle, this is another thermal history that is viable at those early times as well.
Is it the earlier the recoupling, the larger the scale of the effect?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I get about something related to that? Yeah. The perturbation operating in Newtonian, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So it was about the gas on the galley. I would not believe that if you didn't account for like nonlinearity effects, like, right?
Right. I mean, and the projections themselves are like, you know, people did some set of simulations and then kind of backtracked, like, here's what error bar you can put on the linear extrapolated power spectrum. Like,
but yeah, like, for me, that's like a mystery because, like, okay, what do you assume there, right? Like, I don't know.
Right. No, look, so exactly. So the thing is, like, the point is that right now, we are sort of at the moment where we are about to get a bunch of data at these small scale, or, you know, data that nominally tells us about these small scales. If you want to actually be able to use that to do tests like this, you have to do not only a larger set of simulations than has been done, you have to do a better set of simulations that has been done. That's I think of that as the content of Rahul's talk, if I can summarize. Yeah.
So you're coupling to this dark radiation field.
Yep.
Right. And what do you need to assume about that? Have those assumptions.
The main assumption that affects what I'm showing here is probably that temperature, because if you were to do like a dark radiation field that is exactly at the same temperature as a standard model, then you have to contend with ineffective constraints. Which I mean, you can have a real scalar, fine, but just to be on the safe side, we took a temperature ratio of about a half, which does change the energy density. So that just changes how much the dark radiation can feed back onto the dark matter.
So that thing you're just saying is decoupled at some point very early on. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Don't worry about it.
Pretty much.
Like if I wanted to correlate things more strongly with the standard model, is that hard?
You mean to have
to make it so if I do recoupling, I think I'm recoupling to the plasma.
Yeah, good. So like I don't think there's like a no-go that you can't do it, but I think that doing it at a scale at which you would be able to see something observable from it is very challenging. I mean, just because, I mean, look at the temperatures here, right? Like, you need this recoupling to happen quite late if you want to be sensitive to it, even with, you know, these sort of futuristic projections that involve all this simulation effort, right? So I think, again, if you have some other probe of interest of the dark matter phase-based distribution, then sure. Otherwise, I'm not going to try to engineer a recoupling to the standard model at like 10 EV. That seems difficult.
I mean, like looking at the bottom, I'm like, well, could all of my electrons all my photons, instead of scattering off of electrons at the last scattering surface, accidentally bounced off the dark matter?
I have no idea how that would look. Yeah. I mean, so there actually is. There's one paper from some years ago, which looks at a kind of kinetic recoupling with the standard model bath that's not to a radiation field, though. So you don't get these same kinds of structural effects, but you could think about taking that model and seeing if you can run with it, seeing if you can add radiation without, I don't know, diluting ineffective too much. It seems challenging.
People have looked at dark matter photon interactions and what that does to structure. Like there's a paper by Silly Found.
Yeah. No, right. I mean, so all the technology is there. It's just that it seems like.
But it's not decoupling then recoupling.
Yeah. No, no. So the paper I'm talking about is one that actually was decoupled then recoupled. But it's like, I don't think there's a no-go. It just doesn't seem like here. What we wanted to do was basically to be able to say, what do these generally look like, right? What is the, you know, what are the general characteristics of these recouplings? And there, you want to have some freedom to play and like, where can you put it? How big can it be? How long can it last? I don't think you have like any freedom if you try to do this with standard model. That'd be my guess.
So for the freezing case, would be like super complicated because
yes,
and you have to go to the.
You have
phase
to use, phase, exactly,
no.
You have to evolve the whole phase space.
Like
which is why we didn't do it yet.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the nice thing about this recoupling story is that if you assume that it was, you know, in equilibrium, and then it was only out of equilibrium for a short time, you get to use these equilibrium phase space assumptions, yeah.
Is it possible to enhance the power by at some scale?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, again, a very contrived thing to do, but I mean, if you look back at, I think the right slide to show is this one. The basic issue is going to be that when you recouple to the dark radiation, the dark radiation has been smoothing out structure, right? And when you recouple to it, now you're going to inherit that structural erasure. So I would pretty well expect that you're generally going to reduce structure. I think I've seen like one numerical example where indeed the way that the theta perturbation evolves does coincidentally give you a little tiny bit more structure, but I think it's Yeah, it's not a common thing.
Is it possible to recouple to something else, not a dot creation, something that can, you know, roll structures even faster?
You mean if you, good? So I mean, in principle, yes, absolutely. So, like, if you wanted to enhance structure formation, the issue I see there is that energy density is tricky, right? Because with the dark radiation, you have this advantage that the radiation is you know, redshifting faster. So at early times, there's a lot of energy there, and you can, you know, share a lot with the dark matter. If you are coupling to something that is growing in structure faster than dark matter, then it probably is redshifting slowly. It's probably some other, like, dark matter bath, right? So, I mean, I don't know, maybe you have some weird model in mind where you have some component that is, you know. Yeah. I mean, well, you have something that, like, redshifts really weird, some really, really weird equation of state, right? Then I could see it happening, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, and requires fine tuning or something
like that. I don't know what one can do to get structure growing faster than dark matter with redshift. Faster than dark matter at early times, but I presume that there are some clever, imaginative people in this room who can think of a story.
String network. Then how you read that theory of
that? Well, yeah, I mean, it's redshift slowly for a time, and then redshifts right.
Let us clap.